Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to today's board meeting. As the board will be setting its new committee structure at today's meeting, we'll be conducting all of the board's business for the month of July at this meeting. So I'd like to recognize, recognize the secretary for the purpose of determining a quorum.
Chair Evans?
Present.
Vice Chair Crawford?
Present.
Vice Chair Corcoran?
Present.
Director McMillan? Director Price?
Here.
Director Goldman? Director Dorsey?
Present.
Director Horner?
Here.
Mr. Chairman, you have a quorum.
Okay, thank you very much. The next item on the agenda is the safety contact. Mr. Lavin?
I'm not Mr. Lavin. I'll be...
Oh, no, you're not Mr. Lavin. Where's Mr. Lavin? Okay. All right. Tell us who you are.
Okay, my name is Greg Kupka. I'm with the safety department. And in case of an emergency this morning, we will egress through the main doors or the closest exit, which are illuminated by an exit sign. We will assemble on the lawn of the National Building Museum. An automated external defibrillator is available behind the guard station. Fire extinguishers are located throughout the building, and the restrooms are located past the guard desk on the left. They safety contact and focus on heat-related illness. According to the CDC, on average, over 600 people die from complications related to extreme heat each year in the United States. These deaths and illnesses are preventable, but it's important to identify the warning signs and react swiftly and appropriately when they arrive. Heat exhaustion is the precursor to heat stroke and is the result of the body overheating. Symptoms include heavy sweating, rapid pulse, dizziness, fatigue, muscle cramps, nausea, headache, and cool, damp skin with goosebumps, all while still in the heat. When heat exhaustion is not addressed, heat stroke can follow. Those symptoms include high body temperatures, altered mental state or behavior, nausea and vomiting, flushed skin, rapid breathing, and a racing heart rate. If heat exhaustion is suspected, you should remove the sufferer from the heat and cool them down by providing shade, loosening tight-fitting clothing, misting the body with water, and placing ice packs in the armpits and groin, and rehydrate. If you or someone is experiencing heat stroke, seek immediate medical attention.
Okay, thank you very much for your report. Next item on the agenda is the approval of the agenda. I move the agenda. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The next item on the agenda, the approval of the minutes for the June 28, 2018 board meeting, June 28, 2018 executive session, May 10, 2018 Capital and Strategic Planning Committee, May 24th, 2018 Capital and Strategic Planning Committee in Executive Session, June 14th, 2018 Safety and Service Delivery Committee, June 14th, 2018 Finance and Budget Committee, June 28th, 2018 Business Oversight Committee, and June 28th, 2018 Business Oversight Committee in Executive Session. So I'd like to move the approval of all of these minutes. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. Next item on the agenda is the public comment. First individual is Amir Flippin of Urban Public Finance. Okay, welcome to the Metro Board meeting.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Amir Flippin, and I'm the founder of a new startup called Urban Public Finance. And we're actually a pending crowdfunding world waiting for approval by the SEC and FINRA. In conjunction with that, we just got approved yesterday by the Board of Elections here in Washington for a new initiative measure. Well, we didn't get approved, but we got our petition forms released on a ballot initiative that we're trying to get passed. Maybe not for the November election, but election following that. So we'd like to try and get on your agenda at some point in the future to try and develop an alliance with Metro. The idea is that we'd like to sort of market our new initiative, which is called the Money Supply Increase Plus 3000 initiative. The summary statement is, if enacted, this initiative will allow all citizens and recipients of social services in the District of Columbia to invest up to $3,000 in startup companies and to retain assets without losing state and federal subsidies and benefits. So that's the initiative that we're trying to get on the ballot. We have to gather about 24,000 signatures, which is about 5% of the 5% of the number of voters, registered voters here in Washington, D.C. It would be really good if we could get on your list. What we'd like to do is to gather signatures, special permission to gather signatures on the train, and sort of a, we have a consumer in a state of, it's a captive audience, and it's a lot easier to gather the signatures. Also, we'd like to market right outside, about 15 feet outside of the station. We just want to be on your agenda for one of your meetings. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next individual is Denise Rush. Ms. Rush, welcome to the Metro Board.
Good morning, Mr. Evans and board members. My name is Denise Rush, and I'm Vice Chair of the Local Access Subcommittee and Vice Chair of the AAC. Today, I'm just representing the public with their concerns. Main concern is the structure of the board now. Voted last month, and it was approved and accepted that the alternate representatives could not participate with meetings, and the whole structure has changed. And I didn't hear that there is one woman on the board at all. And that's a concern of the public, that as many women writers that we have, that there should be one representative on the board, not just as an alternative, but on the board to make the alternative expertise of people that were on there. They cannot participate. That is a concern. Also, the trial pilot for cash, no cash, that's just discriminatory, because there are so many people who don't have bank accounts, they don't have charges, they don't have access to any of that. They're barely getting on the bus. And have a driver on an express line instead of a line that's really stopping where a lot of people are being picked up. That is a concern. Also, every year, there is a problem in the summertime with the transport that you see. Every summer, cut back, cut off, there's a concern. And so when we do the abilities ride for Maryland, we're wondering, this is the first year now, are we going to have a concern with that? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Rush. Next individual is Heidi Case. Heidi Case? Oh, here you are. I'm sorry. There you are. Okay.
Good
Welcome.
Morning, Welcome. General Manager Rita Felt and board members. I will pick up where Ms. Rush left off. I can usually come and talk about Transport DC. And again, this summer, they took a creative way to cut the program. They cut one of the contractors that took 50% of all the drivers and vehicles out of the loop, and they are unable to provide trips. So they say they didn't cut service, but as of last month, June, which is where the peak usually is, 3,500 less trips were able to be taken on Transport DC because there weren't vehicles to actually provide those rides. And it impacts you all because those people have to find other alternatives, and that can be going back to Metro Access, which the whole goal of this program is to move those trips. So it really, I would watch this summer, and that contract all the way through October 1st, the same thing will continue with Yellow Cab, with 60% of the vehicles can no longer provide service. Secondly, Christian Blake had planned to launch DC Abilities Ride as of July 1st, but he's been unable to do it because there aren't the vehicles. The goal is to give free trips to your highest DC Metro Access users to move them on. But if there aren't vehicles, they're not going to have a good experience and therefore feel like Metro Access is their only choice. So we believe Metro should, it would be better if Metro developed their own contract directly with DC cab drivers, just as you've done in Maryland. Because the problems with the Department for Hire vehicles in D.C. do not stop.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Case. And finally, Kathy Porter. Welcome to the Metro Board.
Thank you. You look so familiar. I am here this morning to support the elimination of the Grosvenor Turnback. I'm sure you all are very surprised to hear that. And I wanted to say that I very much appreciate the analysis and the recommendation that the staff has made that you're looking at this morning to completely eliminate the Grosvenor Turnback. I think that's the right thing to do. I also wanted to point out there's an additional issue that wasn't really addressed in this analysis, which I think makes it even more important than it would otherwise be. And that is there's a great deal of development, transit-oriented development, on that leg of the Red Line between Grosvenor and Shady Grove, particularly closest to the stations of Twin Brook and White Flint. There's a lot of development there right now. There's more development coming online. And that's going to make it very much even more important that there be additional service to that end of the line. I also think that if additional service isn't available, some of those folks who move into that transit-oriented development expecting to get a very easy ride downtown are going to be disappointed and you might not get the full potential that you would otherwise get in terms of ridership and revenue. So there's a lot of reasons, those that are included in your analysis that's in front of you, but also other reasons for you to support completely eliminating the Grosvenor Turnback. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Porter. And that concludes our public comment. The next item on the agenda is a report by the Accessibility Advisory Committee. And Mr. Sheehan. Mr. Sheehan, welcome to the Metro Board.
Thank you very much. Good to be back. I am pinch hitting for Phil Posner this morning. And I have a few things to mention. Number one, for the first time since I've been around, we had several AAC members on the panel that helped pick the new members coming up that you'll see probably sometime in August or September. So we appreciate participating as part of that process, and that I think it's going to be it's well received by the committee, and I think you'll get some quality candidates because of it. Secondly, and you've heard a few of these things this morning already, the 7,000 series cars, the between car door barriers, that is a very critical issue. Disability organizations, particularly American Council of the Blind, which is a nationwide organization, has taken that up. It is a something that we're concerned about. We understand that there was a demonstration last week participated by the FTA and AAC members so that we can make sure those between car door barriers are in place. We would like to see them in place by the December timeframe. I think that's what the FTA is also pushing. It is something that we are going to track because we put a recommendation in 3 years ago, and we had someone fall between the between the car doors as recently as June, and I think that makes the fourth person that's fallen between 2015 and today. So this is a project that we need to track. We will be coming back to you to give you a percentage of completion, and we urge you to support us in making sure that project gets done. Also, it's been noted this morning, and I will reiterate it, that the composition of the board has changed. It is something that the AAC is not in favor of. We feel that the alternative members alternate members should have the same access to the reports, to the meetings. I mean, how can you have a backup if your backups aren't allowed to attend meetings? You have the same access to the reports. I have the same issue when I work. I have a backup, someone who works beside me in case I'm out. They can step in. So I'm concerned about alternate members being able to step in when they haven't had access to the same material as primary members. You've also heard about Abilities Ride. It is an excellent program. Since September, the growth has been very good. It's been getting better every month. Heidi Case indicated that she wants to see that extended to DC, and I would agree with her. The AAC agrees that we need to expand that program. We are also getting indications from Virginia that they are very pleased with what they're seeing, and they would like to see it extended basically region-wide. So that is something that I think is good for us to do. And we're also looking at the buses, the Metro Access vehicles. We understand that the replacement of the upgrades to those buses are coming along. We would like to make sure that that is going to happen in a expedited way. We are very interested in taking a look at the new buses as they roll out to make sure that the fixes that we agreed on are going to be in place. Those are my comments for right now. Committee is working very well. We're very pleased with some of the progress that's being made, but we would also ask for your support, particularly with the between car door barriers, so we can get that project underway. To test and make sure it's going to work properly, make sure that it's done in a timely fashion. Any questions for me?
Any questions for Mr. Sheehan? No questions, Mr. Sheehan. Thank you very much for your report today.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Next item on the agenda is a report by the Riders Advisory Council, and that's Ms. Fogel.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Bob Fogel. I'm Vice Chair of the Riders Advisory Council. Last night, the Riders Advisory Council met for its monthly meeting, and we discovered that today was the last board meeting for the summer. So the members instructed me to come here and just provide you with a little bit of an update about our views on the board's operational review of the Riders Advisory Council. We realize that the board has had a full plate. You've had funding issues, you've had your own reorganizational issues, and what we hope now is at least those issues behind you, and we hope you can turn your attention to this organizational review of the Riders Advisory Council. It began in January. In the interim, we've had some excellent meetings with Christian Dorsey and Catherine Porter, who the board appointed to kind of liaison with us. And my impression, this is my personal impression, is that generally we were in agreement on the issues that need to be resolved. Communication, staffing, coordination, work plans. Those are some of the issues that are on our agenda and on the agenda of the board. And I think that there's plenty of room for negotiation. If we can negotiate, I think we can. And coming up with a good new plan for RAC in the future. So we ask that the board turn its attention to the Riders Advisory Council. We have a good council. We have some very dedicated members. We have a diverse membership, both demographically and in terms of the portions of the metropolitan area they represent. They're interested in Metro. They ride the trains, they ride the buses, they ride the disability, they use the disability system. I think they're very knowledgeable and dedicated, and we would very much like to move on and get this review behind us and proceed to represent the riders in a way that we haven't been able to do in the last 6 months. And work with you to improve the overall system. Thanks. I'll be happy to answer any questions anybody has about.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Fogel. Any questions, comments? Okay, none. Thank you very much, Mr. Fogel. Next item on the agenda is a report by the chair. So good morning, everyone. With the new governance changes in the board's bylaws last month, the board must reorganize its committees to reflect the new format of board's operations. Under the bylaws, the chair has the ability to appoint the new committees. So going forward, the board's committees will be the Executive Committee, the Finance and Capital Committee, and the Safety and Operations Committee. As required by the bylaws, we will vote today on the new committee assignments. So I'd like to move the following committee assignments. The Executive Committee, the Chair, myself, the First Vice Chair, Clarence Crawford, the Second Vice Chair, Jim Corcoran, and the final member, David Horner. For the Finance and Capital Committee, the Chair, Jim Corcoran, the Vice Chair, Steve McMillan, the other members, Corbett Price and Michael Goldman, and the Safety and Service Committee, the Chair, Clarence Crawford, Vice Chair, David Horner, and the other two members, Christian Dorsey and myself. So I'd like to move these assignments at this time. Is there a second? Is there any discussion? Seeing none.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, you have to look to the left as well as to the right.
Yeah, look to the left. You're right. Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to be consistent with my decision from last month that I think the four committee structure that we had previously lived with through June is the better way to proceed. So I will be voting against this new committee structure, not the people that you're assigning to the committees, but the reduction description of the committees to three. My concern is, since I'm most familiar with the finance area, having served on that for the last 2 years, that the way you've structured it, that committee really has too much to do, too broad responsibilities. Besides work on the annual operating budget, which is almost a full-time job in itself, you've assigned to that committee a kind of strategic planning capital budget review function, and you've thrown in as well a assignment to handle the joint development aspects having to do with metro-owned property. I just think this is too much. I think we need a separate committee, as we had for the last year, that deals with broad long-term strategy, that deals with review of the capital budget. I think that's especially needed as we go forward for the next year, the next few years, because our capital budget is going to go as a result of the dedicated funding approved by the various jurisdictions earlier this year from an average of about $1.2 billion a year to probably up to $1.6 to $1.7 billion at the end of the 5 or 6 year cycle. And there's a lot of projects coming on the horizon that this board needs to take oversight over and really be able to study. And I don't see that being done under the current committee structure. I refer to the new 8,000 car rail cars that CF has talked about, procuring new bus procurement, which in light of the bus route restructuring study raises a number of issues as to how many buses we need, and whether we need all the same buses or whether we need a group of smaller buses with 20 or 30 seats as opposed to the standard buses that we order now. And we have a whole air technology project coming along, allowing drivers to use smartphones to access stations and buses. Perhaps this is one card that will be shared with a lot of other of the transit properties in the regional area. But I think that takes a lot of oversight. I don't think that's being done by the proposed structure of the three committees. On top of that, the major objection to having a continuation of four committees last time seemed to be that members would have to serve on two committees, which is true. I'm willing to serve on two committees, and your proposal expects four of the eight members to serve on two committees. So I think if four of us can serve on two committees, all eight of us can serve on two committees, we can do a better job of oversight over the operations of WMATA, and especially in terms of the capital budget and a long-term strategy outlook going forward. So as I said, the personal matter, I don't think this is a very good committee structure, so I will be voting no.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Goldman. Any further discussion? Mr. Dorsey?
So I'll take a slightly different approach, but offer also some concerns with what is proposed. Again, it's not with who is slated to serve on these committees, but it seems that there is not really best practices employed in determining the functions of the executive committee, which has an extremely expansive purview. And while I don't have any issue with there being functionally three committees as opposed to the five which Mr. Goldman proposed, I think three is ultimately better. I think the distribution of work could have been a lot more efficient through the use of ad hoc committees or task forces to separate out some of these functions. As it is, you've got the chairs of the Finance and Capital Committee and Safety and Operations. Those chairs will also have to have, in addition to those areas of work, they have the substantial areas of work that are included in the Executive Committee that they have to master at the same time. It just doesn't seem to be an even distribution. So I would encourage the chairman to think about how to distribute the functions at a later date that is certainly more efficient, resulting in a good workload for the board members, but also to address some key best practices issues. Having the external audit functions consolidated within the executive committee is a practice we've tried to get away from. It seems like we're moving back to that. Also having all of the governance functions within the executive committee probably would be seen by others as not a best practice. So I think within the three committees, if you effectively use task forces and ad hoc committees, you can better distribute the workload and deal with some of those best practice issues.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Dorsey. Further comments? Okay. Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Mr. Goldman, is record Mr. Goldman is voting no. The ayes have it. So the motion passes. Okay, finally, as a reminder, David Horner. David, you got to say yes.
Aye.
Yes. Aye. All right.
Thank you.
All right. We got you. Okay. Finally, as a reminder, it's been stated this is the only meeting of the WMATA board this month, and we will not be meeting in August, as is our tradition. So the next meeting of the board will take place the second Thursday in September, which is September 13th. And this concludes my report, and now recognize the general manager for his report, Mr. Wiedefeld.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I want to hit on three things. One is on a recent project that we did on station lighting, obviously the All-Star game that's coming up next week, and then also the major capital projects that we'll be initiating later this month and through the summer. When we first started thinking about how to improve safety and customer experience through the Back to Good program, one of our goals was to make stations cleaner and brighter. Improving lighting ranks among Metro customers' top priorities, especially those with low vision or other disabilities, and has been a consistent issue with the AAC. I'm pleased to inform the board that over the weekend, Metro completed major lighting upgrades at Union Station. If you haven't been up there, I would suggest you do. I'd take Judiciary Station up to Union Station. You can see the difference. But with these upgrades, the station is now two times brighter than it was just last month, and combined with other lighting improvements in the station, the platform is now eight times brighter than it was in 2016. This work involved completely replacing all track bed lighting fixtures and related infrastructure with 300 new energy-efficient LED light fixtures. And not only will these lighting upgrades improve safety and customer experience, but switching to LED platform lighting is also projected to save Metro on energy and maintenance costs for the long term. Union Station is the first of 20 underground stations that we are scheduled for major track bed lighting upgrades this fiscal year. With Union Station complete, work will begin later this month at Foggy Bottom, Roslyn, and Courthouse, so you'll be seeing it throughout the region, and we will complete the 20 through the fiscal year. In terms of All-Star Week, which actually begins Friday, but next week with the game being played, it's the first time in 50 years that's been played in the district. Whenever there are large numbers of tourists in town, though, it is important to share a few safety tips for navigating the Metro system. First, please avoid lines and help prevent crowds at the stations by purchasing your smart cards in advance. There is a commemorative All-Star Game Smart Trip cards that you can pick up at throughout the system right now. They're being loaded at our station or in our system vending machine throughout the system. today, so you can get those. Second, avoid the number one cause of injury, which is slips, trips, and falls, by walking throughout the stations and carefully navigating the escalators. And finally, Metro train doors do not open up like elevator doors, so you cannot hold them. So please, if the doors are shutting, just step back and wait for a train. It'll be right behind the one that just pulled off. Last week, we announced some other great news for baseball fans. Metro will stay open late for the two back-to-back night games following the Home Run Derby on Monday and the All-Star Game on Tuesday evening. This special late-night service is sponsored by MasterCard in partnership with Major League Baseball, and we want to thank them for both ensuring that the fans can use Metro to attend both these exciting events. In terms of as soon as the All-Star Game is over, that week progresses, we will be moving to our major capital programs throughout the summer. First, we'll be on the Red Line, and later this summer along the Blue, Orange, and Silver Lines. And the Red Line Capital Improvement Project will get underway on Saturday, July 21st, with the shutdown from Noma Gallaudet University to Fort Totten Station and continue until Labor Day. Signs have now been posted at all Red Line stations, and street teams are out at the impacted stations providing in-person notification and travel alternatives to customers. With the exception of one weekend in late July when the shutdown will extend to Tacoma Station, customers can avoid the work on the Red Line by transferring to and from the green and yellow lines at Fort Totten Station. We've also collaborated with the district on a dedicated bus lane along Rhode Island Avenue to speed up local bus routes and shuttle service. A detailed service advisory is available at WMATA.com with maps, brochures, and advice from travel alternatives. And then later this summer, beginning on August 11th, a second major project will take place concurrently on the Blue, Orange, and Silver Lines as we rebuild the sharpest and most heavily traveled curve on the Metrorail system between Metro Center's Smithsonian Station. Additional service information and travel alternatives will be released soon as we approach the start of that project. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my remarks. Be glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wiedefeld. Any questions for the general manager? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. All right, the next item on the agenda are our action items. First, we have three items on which the board will take action today. First, a proposal for additional rush hour service on the Red Line through the elimination of the Grosvenor turnback, meaning that all trains will operate through to Shady Grove. I'll turn the floor over to Mr. Leader, Metro COO, to discuss proposed Red Line service changes.
Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
Today we're here to present our follow-up to the March 8th presentation given to the board to seek approval of the Title VI report and the approval to add peak service on the Red Line. In March, we brought forward options pertaining to the previous board resolution surrounding the Grosvenor turnback on the Red Line, committed to undertake several actions following the March 8th meeting, which included conduct public participation to solicit comments on the proposal, conduct the required Title VI analysis, undertake an operational analysis to maintain service reliability, and to initiate an infrastructure improvement analysis. And this presentation will cover all of these items. This chart shows the three alternatives shown to the board in March: the service levels, the current ridership, the impact of crowding measured in passengers per car, and the cost per impact. Alternative A is the full elimination of the turnback operating 15 trains per hour to Shady Grove. Alternative B is the elimination of the turnback, or partial elimination of the turnback, operating 12 trains per hour to Shady Grove, and alternative C is no change to the present service of 7 to 8 trains per hour to Shady Grove. As required, the public outreach was conducted in April and May and included 49 outreach events at 16 stations and distribution of over 62,000 brochures with target marketing and media, including social media. The primary focus of the outreach was to get riders to participate in an online survey to get their input. The effort resulted in almost 10,000 completed surveys. Survey results indicated that over 70% of the respondents are in favor of the elimination of the turnback and the increase in service. The Title VI equity analysis focused on impacts to minority ridership and low-income population. The analysis on minority customers shows that there is no disparate impact. The initial analysis on low-income populations did show that the proposed additional service would trigger a disproportionate burden, and in accordance to the FTA guidelines, staff took an action to modify this proposal. This action is to add two additional evening trips between Silver Spring and Glenmont as trains are pulling into the yard. This action mitigates the disproportionate burden as much as possible. And our overall conclusion of the equity analysis is that the proposed service should not violate Title VI. To better understand the issues relating to the operating increased service at a Shady Grove terminal, SAF undertook an operational analysis. This included a comprehensive review of the operation at Shady Grove Terminal and the yard. We also contacted other properties, including New York, Philadelphia, and Boston, to understand their terminal operations. We also looked at our own terminals where we operate higher level of train movements. Presently, we operate 15 trains per hour at the Largo Terminal, and we did operate 15 trains per hour at Greenbelt when we were operating the Rush Bus service. The layout at Largo Terminal is different than at Shady Grove. Although the diamond crossovers entering the terminal are the same size, the switches behind the terminals are different, as well as the layout of the tail and the pocket tracks. At Largo, there are three higher speed turnouts behind the terminal, along with three dedicated tail tracks that support its terminal operation and ensure reliability. At Shady Grove, there is a diamond behind the terminal with smaller sized turnouts leading to two yard leads with no dedicated tail tracks. Although we have a 4-minute headway, although we have run a 4-minute headway out of Shady Grove before, the existing layout does not allow for good recovery and incidents and a good separation of the yard and the mainline operations. As a result of this analysis, the operation will add emphasis on train movements between the yard and the station by having additional supervision and having personnel available to facilitate train movements. This added supervision will also help to respond to incidents along the right-of-way, and this personnel adjustment can be made within the budget approved last month. And this is what we learned by talking to the other properties, what they do. When they have a terminal in close proximity to a yard, additional supervision is needed, additional staff will be needed on the platforms to clear the trains out as quickly as possible. To reduce the future risk to service reliability, staff has initiated an engineering analysis of potential infrastructure improvements. These improvements should include interlocking upgrades, the addition of a pocket track, and track improvements. This study will also investigate adding an additional stairway at Shady Grove Station to ease vertical access problems in the future as ridership continues to grow. This analysis will be completed by the end of the financial year 2019, and any recommended improvements can be incorporated in future capital programs. So today, we are seeking board approval of both Title VI report and the staff's recommendation to eliminate the Grove's turnback and operate the 4-minute headway to Shady Grove beginning this December. Preparation for a December startup of additional service, staff will hire and train operating personnel and develop procedures to manage the increase of service. We will also prepare and distribute all of the informational material over the next 4 months. Staff will also complete the infrastructure analysis by the end of fiscal year 2019.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Leader. Are there any questions? Mike, you have your hand up.
Yeah, I don't have a question. I just want to show my appreciation to the center and the general manager and staff for conducting this analysis. Their recommendations to eliminate all the turnback, of course, is consistent with the action that the board took in 2015, and it's consistent with the long desire and wishes for service improvement by Montgomery County and the state of Maryland. We also just point out that the survey that was undertaken, that I referred to, showed that almost 60%, 59% of the people surveyed favored option A, elimination of full elimination of the turnback so that all trains would go beyond Grosvenor to Shady Grove. And that 60% was roughly consistent across all ethnic and minority groups and across income groups, splitting between under 30 and above 30,000 in the people surveyed. So it's an improvement in service broadly wished by both governments as well as the residents and users. And as I stated last month when we approved the funding, in the FY19 budget for these additional Red Line services. This was part of a regional Metrorail service improvement deal whereby Maryland supported funding in Virginia for Blue Line and Orange Line power upgrades, accelerated eight-car train service exchange. Maryland's desire for increased Red Line service period was approved pending receipt of sufficient rail cars, and clearly that is the case at this time. I would also like to just note that, three documents that were included in the materials were board members and I assume the public on the revenue turn back issue, a report by the Montgomery County Department of Transportation, a report from the Washington Suburban Transit Commission, and a report from the Rail Transit Ops Group of Public Interest Transit Group. What's important for you to note, and I encourage you to read those studies, is, as pointed out by my colleague, Ms. Porter, is a good deal of development north of Grosvenor, and as the Montgomery County report points out, that additional commercial as well as residential development out there will provide numerous additional riders on the Red Line. So meeting their needs with train service every 4 minutes rather than the current 8 minutes will be a big improvement in service for them and the county's growth plans. And finally, these reports also point out some analysis of the activities on the Red Line on June 12th, the CAPS celebration day, where was ever any real-world example needed that 15 trains per hour could be operated. Peak period between Grove and Shady Grove, that day approval. During that midday period, WMATA operated, these studies point out, between 13 and 16 trains per hour to and from Shady Grove. Ridership, these are crowded trains, ridership north of Grosvenor was up by 94%. WMATA reported the total Red Line on-time performance for all periods on June 12th was 95.9%. Reliability is very high. On-time performance during the heaviest volume period was 99%. In fact, the WMATA report indicates that the only significant delay on the Red Line on June 12th, after Celebration Day, was the result of a southbound train at Rockville striking a deer just before 11 p.m. So that we did very well, except for unexpected emergencies. And so I'm confident that the Red Line service to Grosvenor, north of Grosvenor, during peak periods will be carried out in December efficiently, reliably, and meet the needs of both riders and the communities served along that stretch of Montgomery County. Grosvenor, thank you again.
Okay, further discussion? Okay, seeing none, I move approval.
Mr.
Chair. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Maybe are you going to make an amendment?
Yeah, but a couple questions.
Oh, first. Okay, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So, you know, I appreciate the comments and the data and the reports, and certainly I'm not surprised that the survey of the ridership increase indicates that they would benefit from more service. I think if we did that survey across any line of the system, we would see similar results. In fact, I'm surprised it was only 70%. You ask others who are dealing with headways of 12 minutes, I would think that overwhelmingly they would favor decreasing headways. That notwithstanding, the question remains from all of this is that, Mr. General Manager, some months ago, you expressed some concerns both on, you know, the near-term operating budget, implications to service and reliability, as well as, you know, unknown capital issues related to entertaining this idea at this time. And it seems like all the data and analysis that you've done have alleviated those concerns. But can you just sort of walk me through to what extent the issues that you raised several months ago when we first considered this have been eased?
Thank you. I'd be glad to. One, on the budget issue, you know, as we stated in the development of the budget, anything above and beyond the 3% for new was clearly acceptable, but had to be approved by the board as above and beyond the 3%, which is what occurred last month. So that's dealt with that issue. And Joe and his team, in reaching out to other properties, basically found a way to manage this through increased staff and supervisors, both at the platform and in the yards, to do that. But we're also, as we've said from the beginning, is we need to take a look at the capital investment that would be needed. So that will be done by the end of this fiscal year, and that may lead to a request for additional, or you know, additional projects into the future to make sure this consistently operates efficiently. And again, our concern has always been, if something happens along the lines, how to recover very quickly. And that's why we want to make sure that the capital infrastructure is there to do that. But we feel comfortable that we can manage it in this period to do it. And we also do recognize, obviously, that this is very important to the region from other perspectives. So we bring our technical skills, but we also realize the economic development and everything that's happening now in that area, as we do with other parts of the region. So we do weigh that into our thinking as well.
Okay, thank you. It's helpful. Next, I'd like to turn to the Title VI analysis, and I just don't understand this well enough. So as we measure, it seems like here we measured to determine equity and burden, we measured across the red line. But, you know, again, several months ago, some of the concerns were what will be the impacts to the system elsewhere, not just including the red line, but to core service that Metro was already running. So why for the Title VI are we just looking at narrow impacts along the red line as opposed to the system as a whole?
When we do our Title VI analysis of any project, we look at the impacts of that specific project sort of to the average of the rest of our system, both for minorities and for low income. As we increased service in Montgomery County on the red line, the impact for minorities is it tends to give service to people that are higher income, not necessarily a low income system. So it's a little bit of a disparity to our normal. So when we did the analysis, we looked at it and came out a small disparity. We try to keep within it's all an important slight target below 6.0. This one came up 6.18. So we looked with our planning staff and said, what else could we do as we're doing this that would help a minority area in our system? And we looked at the red line because we were changing the red line. We're doing pull-ins and pull-outs differently. So as we're pulling trains in and out of eastern side of the red line on Glenmont, the solution comes up to be, instead of having a couple of trains in the evening, 7:30 to 8:15, turn back at Silver Spring to go back to Shady Grove, we're going to pull those trains in live for our customers up to Glenmont. And that analysis, which benefits a lower minority group of people, makes the Title VI analysis consistent with our recommendations.
Okay. So the next piece of that is I was reading the Title VI, and correct me if I just read this wrong, but it seems like some of the mitigation strategies that you're employing are already in place. Is that some of the mitigation strategies that you were crediting to your Title VI mitigation are already in operations?
I did not hear your question. I apologize.
No, yeah, and maybe I may not be understanding this correctly, but it seems like the mitigation strategies that were outlined as part of how you're dealing with the disproportionate impact piece are already in place. So I guess I didn't quite understand how those could be Title VI mitigations if you're already doing them.
I'm sorry. When we change the service on the red line and add the extra trains that we're adding, the three extra trains, it's in difference of where they come from in the morning, what yard they're stored at. And so we made some changes recently last June when we changed the service. We moved some trains from Glenmont up to Glenmont. So we moved some trains around. When we add these three extra trains, if we have two of them come out of Shady Grove and one come out of Glenmont, it changes how we pull trains in and out. And by making those trains live come December, we will have two extra trips going up to Glenmont.
I see. So I think, Mr. Chairman, at this point, I think there's we could have lots of questions, but I think in order to sort of give me comfort moving forward and to be consistent with the way we've dealt with service changes in the past, I'd like to offer an amendment, which I do very much apologize. I only circulated to you all very late this morning. But it is something that I think is consistent with past practices, and I don't know how you'd like to handle it since everybody has a copy. Would you like me to read it or to just summarize its intent?
Mr. George, before I get there, let me move the motion and get a second so I can get the item before us, and then I'll recognize you to read the amendment. So at this point, I'd like to move approval for additional red line service. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, the motion is before us. Mr. Dorsey, for your amendment, if you would not mind reading it.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is just to amend the resolution to add two resolve clauses, and it would ask that the, or it would resolve that the board directs the general manager to report to the Safety and Operations Committee on a quarterly basis beginning in calendar year 19, Metro service results after eliminating the turn back and the performance of increased peak period red line service so that the Safety and Operations Committee can examine ridership revenue and efforts to align services with demand, impacts to system operations and crowding, and in conjunction with the Finance and Capital Committee, determine whether increased peak period service on the red line is needed beyond fiscal year 19 to ensure safe, reliable, and equitable rail service. And I would also add a resolve clause that says that the board directs the general manager to provide a comprehensive report on increased red line service, including all those details talked about in the previous resolve clause, to the full board no later than May of 2019, and that this board take action to affirmatively continue this level of service beyond the next fiscal year. And if I could just briefly explain sort of what this is trying to get at, since even though the report seems to favorably indicate that WMATA can handle all this, I am somewhat concerned that there are a lot of impacts that we don't know yet, and it seems like before we bake in a long-term commitment to this, we should give ourselves period to make sure it's actually working as intended and also that it's delivering the service results that we hope. So it's to put in a mechanism for us to continue to look at this, much as we have with the opposite of decreasing service hours, for example, where we are looking at it every year to see if it's meeting our expectations. And then secondarily, when we consider the capital implications of this, I'm very much concerned about our not having an opportunity to make sure we are monitoring this expressly before we have staff automatically commit to building a capital program to deal with any impacts. I hope that the impacts are not realized and we don't need to do anything. But in the event that we do, I want to make sure this board is affirmatively on top of that in advance.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Dorsey's amendment is before us. Is there a second? It's been made and seconded. Is there any further discussion on Mr. Dorsey? Mr. Goldman.
I actually think this is a good suggestion, and I do rise to support it. In fact, I think there's a precedent for future action when we open a new station in Alexandria in the next few years, and when we open Silver Line Phase 2, we do exactly the same thing because the experience with Silver Line in Phase 1 has shown that the protections that were there turned out to be a big disappointment. The service results were producing more diversion than new passengers. And I think it's a good practice for us to look at all these service changes. I think we'll do the same if we ever vote to expand late night service again. And so any kind of service improvement like this is something that we just should, as precedent going forward, decide to review each year and affirmatively have to commit to approving each year. So I rise in support of Mr. Dorsey's amendment.
Okay. Further discussion? Yes, Mr. McMillan.
Just very briefly, as my colleagues noted, I oppose the addition of the operating budget amendment on this item. I think this is a very prudent proposal from Mr. Dorsey. The only number that I've seen presented this board on the potential capital impact here is was in a range of $20 to $30 million, which I think meets us well deserving of another look when we have a little more data before us at the engineering analysis. So thank you for offering him in. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further? Okay. Seeing none, all in favor of Mr. Dorsey's amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay, so who opposed it? Oh, Mr. Price. Okay. Mr. Price is recorded as saying no. Okay, the amendment passes. So we have before us now the additional red line service approval as amended by Mr. Dorsey's amendment. So that is before us. Is there any discussion on that? Okay, seeing none. All in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The ayes have it. Okay, the next item on the agenda. We will hear a report on Metro's parking pilot program and consider staff's request to hold a public hearing to get feedback on proposed changes. This item will authorize Metro to charge a lower non-rider rate to commuter rail riders who park at Metro lots at shared stations. So I'll ask Director of Real Estate Nina Albert to present this item. Welcome to the board, Ms. Albert.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. There are a number of embedded actions for this parking, for this compact public hearing authorization that I'll go through. And there are four specific board authorizations or approvals that we're seeking. The first is, and the most important, is authorization to conduct compact public hearings on these parking pilots that we initiated February 5th of this year. We would like to extend the parking hours and fees that we set forth in the pilots through the end of 2018. I'll explain further why that is. We've also completed a Title VI equity analysis on the pilots, have the results of that, and seek board acceptance of those results. And then finally, the non-rider fee program that we've applied also since February 5th is not a pilot. It's a permanent program, but we've discovered some impacts that program has had on some important regional rail systems, and so we're seeking board approval at this time to make sure that VRE and MARC riders that park at Metro stations where we have applied a non-rider fee are only charged the rider rate and not the the non-rider fee. And I'll, again, talk more about that. The three pilots were approved by the board July 2017. We began implementing them and initiated the pilot on February 5th. We also, at the same time, implemented that non-rider fee program on February 5th. And then the period of the pilot is through July 31st currently. Next. So I'll start first with the permanent program. It's achieved what we hoped it would, which is that we knew, because we can see where there are stations with unusually high credit card usage, that there are people who are not riding the transit system, but who are parking at Metro parking because it's either cheaper or more convenient than the private parking surrounding the Metro station. And so that is what the non-rider fee program is designed to do, is to differentiate between people who are riding the system and want to park, and that's what the parking is provided for. But in the case that there are people who are not riding the system, that we have more flexibility to command more market rate rates. So this is what we found today. So we, before staff had broader authority to apply the non-rider fee program, we had only applied it at three stations. So for a long time now, New Carrollton, White Flint, and Twin Brook have had a non-rider program or fee applied. So starting February 5th, we added an additional 10 stations. So right now, 13 total stations have non-rider programs, or non-rider fees, I should say. So we now have some numbers, which is pretty impressive. This is in a four-month period, 56,000 non-rider transactions. On the right, I've provided the stations and the percentage of people who are parking who are non-riders. There are a couple notable ones. Greenbelt, 35% of the people parking there are non-riders. Minnesota Avenue, 84% of the people parking there are not riding the Metro system. And then at Rockville, 22% are parking and not riding the Metro system. And then the others are notable as well. They're above 10%. 10% is our threshold where it seems pretty normal. So anything above that, we believe that we applied the non-rider fee in the right place. We believe that this is, so in real dollars, in the last 4 months, we collected $867,000. If you extrapolate that to annual income, this would be potential revenue of $2.6 million. Again, this is in line with what our projections were. I'm really glad that what we've discovered so far is confirmation of this. We did find, however, particularly at Franconia Springfield, that VRE, and Mr. Goldman, you've mentioned before in the past, at Greenbelt when we were talking about applying the non-rider fee there, a concern about MARC riders, that there are VRE and MARC riders that park at metro stations and then don't access the metro station. They go directly to work. Both of those organizations, or VRE in particular, has contacted us, and we've devised a solution that would be quite simple for Metro and VRE and, by extension, MARC, for them to implement. That solution set is completed. However, we would need board approval to exempt those two groups of commuter riders that are not metro riders, but they are part of the regional system, commuting system, and transit group to exempt them from the non-rider fee. So that's that. So on to the pilots. There were three of them. The first was to start revenue hours on weekdays as early as 7:30 in the morning rather than at 9:30. We also wanted to test weekend hours of operation. And then lastly, we wanted to test the impact of lowering parking fees, particularly at very low utilization stations. I want to point out a couple things. These are our preliminary results that I'm going to share with you. We're not asking the board today to approve any of these pilots, but I want to share these preliminary results before we go into the compact public hearing. And then we would come back to the board this fall with the results of the compact public hearing on each of these pilots. We would finish our data collection, and at that point you can make a fully informed decision about whether or not to adopt any of these. We did a number of customer, you know, direct outreach to customers in addition to online surveys and others. And then, of course, I mentioned we did the Title VI analysis. So expanding weekday hours, we began at 7:30 in the morning, and we just adjusted the hours so that it would consistently say 1 hour after station closure, because weekday and weekend station closure hours are a little bit different. So we had 36,000 new transactions early morning. Our customer surveys found that only 1.3% of our metro riders are parking and riding during that time period, meaning they're leaving the system and returning home. And so the majority of those new transactions are non-riders. So again, this confirmed what our hypothesis was, is that there are people parking overnight who are not riding transit but taking advantage of the parking that's available. We earned $185,000 during those 4 months. That includes non-rider fees at the stations that I mentioned earlier. We did not receive any minimal customer complaints, really none that I can think of offhand, honestly. And there weren't any operational issues. Before we could consider permanently adopting this, this needs to go before a compact public hearing. Next. Weekend hours. We wanted to explore what the impact would be for charging for parking on weekends. Practically, for the pilot, it did not make sense to do both Saturday and Sunday, so we just did the weekend hours on Saturdays because the numbers on Saturday and Sunday are very similar from a ridership perspective. This is the first time that Metro has collected Saturday parking data in any kind of real way. And so the results are very interesting. 113,000 transactions over 4 months. We only applied a $2 parking rate. We were concerned that applying the full, you know, $4.95 a day on weekends would shock people too much and even further deter them from riding on weekends. So we just wanted to apply enough so that we could close the gates and collect the data that we needed. So we set that rate at $2, and so we collected, you know, $500,000. There are some things that are notable, which is the March for Our Lives event that occurred in March. And you see this pretty significant surge of Saturday riders on that day. So 28,000 of our total transactions, that's about 25% of our total Saturday transactions, were for that one event. There was an operational issue that we identified, and that is that we did not charge at the Kiss and Rides, and so people quickly figured that out and didn't park at the Park and Ride, instead parked at the Kiss and Ride. In our customer outreach that we did, this is primarily before the pilot started, but also during the pilot, about a third of the people said that they would stop riding Metro, period, if there was any charge on Saturday. However, once it was actually in action, we didn't receive very many, if any, customer complaints at all. So there's a little bit of a disconnect between what the survey results said and what the actual customer complaint levels were when we implemented it. Again, I would like to gather more information at the compact public hearing. I would like to discern whether people are sensitive to full-time application of Saturday hours or weekend hours, and what the acceptance is, for example, for regional events like a March for Our Lives or any other kind of major festival like that, if people are less sensitive to charging on Saturdays for those days and would want to get public feedback on both of those cases. This is a pretty complicated set of results that we've gotten from lowering the parking rates. We were very cautious in where we applied that. We were concerned about cannibalization, meaning that people who are parking currently at one Metro station, we would maintain that same transit rider, and they would just move over to another station to take advantage of the cheaper parking rate, rather than doing what this intended to do, which is attract new transit riders. That's what we were hoping to understand. So we lowered the rate at Landover and at West Falls Church to $3. What we did see, and this is what the bottom chart shows, is approximately a 8% increase in utilization at Landover and a 5% increase in utilization at West Falls Church. So that is a positive. We are seeing that increased utilization. We are also seeing, because the $3 applies to everybody who was historically parking there as well, we are seeing a loss in revenue. Not surprising. What we have not had an opportunity to do is evaluate the registered Smart Trip cards and see if what in fact is happening is cannibalization from New Carrollton to Landover, for example, and from East Falls Church to West Falls Church, which are the closest stations to both of these pilot locations. The customer survey results give us a little bit of an indication. 30% of folks at customers said that they would ride more often with lower fees. 10% indicated that they would just divert from where they're currently parking. Kind of similar results for West Falls Church. We want to do more analysis of this, and I think the information that will be most telling as we move forward is our analysis of Smart Trip card users and seeing if those percentages remain the same or if, in fact, they might be a little bit higher. Next. In advance of implementing the pilots, for the Title VI analysis requirements, we did a significant public outreach program that included pop-up events, brochure distribution, stakeholder communication across various platforms, emails, in-person outreach, signage, did a number of different marketing and media outreach. And then the intercept and email surveys, meaning that people were there at the parking lots at 13 different stations, intercepting people as they were coming into the Metro station or leaving and going to park. So the results of the Title VI analysis show no disparate impact to minority customers or disproportionate burden to low-income customers for any of the pilots. So no impact for any of the three pilots proposed. We would like the board to accept and approve the results of the Title VI equity analysis in large part because it is required in order to continue these pilots beyond 3 months. Next. So the topics for the compact public hearing are actually going to include not only feedback on the pilots, but actually on a couple other things too, because we're trying to modernize how we do business for parking. So we would like to implement different types of payment technologies, for example, Park Mobile, which everybody's familiar with, or perhaps an app. So we would like to get feedback from the public while we're out there talking to them about parking for some of those payment methodologies, as well as extending weekday hours and weekend hours of revenue and the lower rates. Next. Okay. So the reason for bringing or wanting to extend the pilot beyond July 31st is because we are planning to do the compact public hearing in September. So if the pilot expires and we return back to the original rates, and the board decides in, let's say, October or November to approve any of those rates, the customer experience will be a little bit of a flip-flop. So they're now accustomed to, you know, what the new rates are. Then we would pull them back, and then we would re-implement them. So it's just a little bit of a up and down from a customer perspective. So we would like to maintain them for consistency purposes, you know, through the end of this calendar year, and then starting January 1, 2019, we would conform the rates to whatever it is the final board approvals are. Next. So that is these are the four items that we're asking for your approval on, and I'll just stop now for any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Elbert. Any questions? Steve?
Two things. First of all, just a comment that as we look at the data going forward, I hope we'll look at not just, you know, 4 months of last year versus 4 months of this year, but what the trend has been since these new measures were introduced. My guess is that the demand response and people figuring out workarounds is, in many cases, going to take weeks or months. And so if we're just looking at a broad average, we may be missing things that people in the marketplace are figuring out, and the results might not look like. So next time we see some data, if there's enough to show it in a meaningful way, I hope we could see some trend from the inception of these new measures to people figuring out how to respond to them.
Okay.
Second thing here, and I will acknowledge that perhaps I'm looking at the last item more narrowly than perhaps I should, but the logic of the exemption for VRE and Mark Riders. So default for a non-rider of our system is we want to charge you an amount that better recaptures our investment in the parking facility, but if we can get other revenue out of you by having you ride our system, then we'll give you a break on that price. That is not the case for this admittedly very limited number of VRE and Mark riders that we're talking about here, but other than, you know, being, you know, making a charitable contribution to the broader cause of mass transit in the region, what's the rationale for exempting these non-riders versus other non-riders who are not, in fact, paying into our system?
Yeah.
I think you did hit it. I mean, that is the rationale, is that basically it's in support of transit and the investment that VRE and Mark have made and trying to build up that transit ridership as well. Along the way, I think, though, as that ridership grows, it also does impact us because a lot of those riders do use our system, you know, further down the road. So it was really based on that and some of the implications they had at the local level, which was a bigger concern for them.
Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nina, I want to say thank you to you and the entire staff for figuring out this VRE and MARC system. I know it was a contentious issue for VRE, so thank you for doing that on behalf of Virginians. I'm confused by a few of your numbers that you're throwing around, so if I could ask a couple of those questions. Could you define a transaction for me? Is that when someone pays, or is that when someone uses the parking facility?
So those are one and the same, but yes, it's when somebody pays.
Okay, so if someone's parking there overnight and didn't pay, that's not a transaction when they come out.
Correct.
Okay.
So we're trying to capture those people.
Okay. So, but even having said that, when we started to charge, there was a reduction in
transactions.
I think it's slide four. So there were 56,000 and change non-rider transactions, and that was a decrease of 24,000.
So what we haven't had a chance to do yet, and this is getting a little bit to Board Member McMillan's comment, is that we haven't been able to tease out yet. There's a general, the ridership trend dropping as well. So we haven't been able at this time to isolate what is the overall, there's a very high correlation between parking and ridership trending. So if ridership trending is dropping, so is parking dropping, generally. So what we'd like to do in our next phase here of data analysis is tease out that decrease of 23,000 transactions. Is that because of the non-rider fee and non-riders are now figuring things out and finding alternatives? Or is that, that would be the... we're looking at this slide in particular, which was confusing me. What I'm talking about is a general statement. We have not been able to tease out for any of these pilots, you know, if that transaction number is different from the exact same period the year before, is that because of general ridership trend drops or is that because of these parking pilots? We need to do that work, period. For this particular slide, so we now have 56 non-rider transactions. That we know. We are guesstimating that drop of transactions, people are diverting and doing something else. Non-riders are dropping and doing something else because now we're lifting rates. But we're able to increase revenue overall by charging non-riders. People are still choosing to stay. And that increase in revenue, because we now have a higher non-rider rate, is overcoming the fact that there's a drop of 27,000 transactions. The non-rider thing is very unique because it's such a dramatic fee increase.
That's fully a third of people have left during that time, and you still...
Non-riders have left.
Okay. And so, you've still been able to increase the overall revenue.
Correct.
Okay.
So where there are people who have choices or were choosing to park at Metro because it was a block closer than some other alternative, we lost those people. But to us, from a revenue perspective, we're doing much better by charging the non-rider rate and losing those transactions than not.
Okay. And then one other question I have, and it's about the impact on this year's budget. I think going back to the January budget hearings, we projected there'd be $6 million of new parking revenue, but if you factor out all these numbers here, it looks like it's going to be about 4.2, somewhere in that neighborhood. How are we doing versus our projected numbers?
So right now, based on the information that we've received with this, we're factoring closer to $5 million. So it would be a decrease in $1 million from what we originally projected. That is generally, it's wholly because the Saturday fees, when we were doing the projection, was assuming $4.95 daily rate, and instead we only applied $2. So that's where that $1 million comes in. We've discussed how to make up that $1 million and believe that we can do it through non-fare programs. So there's some real estate transactions that we believe will make up the difference.
Okay, thank you.
Any further? Michael?
You mentioned the Greenbelt has a large parking facility that has non-riders. If my colleague, Mr. Augustine, was up here, he would also point out that New Carrollton has the same phenomena, large number of non-riders as well as park riders using that facility. My question is, in your workup, there's a statement staff has identified a technological solution for exempting commuter rail riders from paying the non-rider free fee, but requires board approval. So I guess two questions are there. What is the technological solution, and are you asking for board approval for that today, or does that come after the public hearing?
No, we're asking today for the board to approve the exemption of the non-rider fee for VRE and MARC riders. So that would be today. We're not asking for board approval of the technology solution, just of the exemption. What the technology solution is actually not so technically complicated, but it's issuing, it's a partnership. We haven't, Mark and we have not talked about this, but it's the same solution for Mark. But VRE, and we have been spending some time, we would issue a special set of smart trip cards, basically a pass, parking pass, to VRE, and VRE would confirm that these are VRE riders. And manage that. So VRE would pay for those cards, and we would lock in the parking rate at the daily rate by station.
So a Mark rider could not use his Mark multiple trip card. He'd have to get one of these new smart trip cards.
Correct, but from Mark. So from the same point of sale that they get, you know, their other monthly pass or Mark pass from.
So who loads the smart trip card? Mark will do it for the riders, or the riders will do it?
So we will program the Smart Trip card, give them to Mark, and or Mark would buy them from us, you know, these preloaded cards, and then Mark would issue them to their customer, and then their customer could load money onto that Smart Trip card.
So the Mark rider would use his Mark card traveling on the train.
Correct.
This special Smart Trip card for access.
Correct.
Yep.
Anything further? Christian?
Thank you. So I look forward to a couple things. I realize we have lots of data and analysis questions, and while I could pepper you with them all today, I do realize that we have the whole public hearing process to get through them all. So I'll just hit it a few that I'm interested in. If you have answers, great. If not, just put them on your agenda to think about. But I want to start first with just process. And in the resolution, we are delegating to the general manager the authority to set the docket for the public hearing. And as part of that, I was wondering if it is possible for the GM to, in addition to the $2 fee that we're currently charging on weekends, to also put other scenarios out there to invite comment on?
Yes.
Specifically lower fees? You know, nominal fees such as 50 cents or a dollar, you know, those are the kinds of things that you actually talked about when this was introduced, as this was a data collection exercise, and you eventually landed on $2. But I think it's important to get the public's feedback on different rates so we could establish some elasticities to really figure out what are the things that compel people to use the parking facilities and the system. So if that's generally amenable to you, I'm comfortable with just articulating it publicly today. But in terms of data, as we look at Saturday, your materials, Ms. Albert, presume no loss in Saturday riders, which of course we don't really know yet.
Right.
But have we looked at the, I know that you haven't looked comprehensively at the Smart Trip data, but have you sort of been able to look at general ridership trends to see whether or not the parking fees have produced any sort of change at stations, and specifically have you used Wheelie Rest and East as a comparator, because through separate authority, the parking fees are not in place there. So have we been able to compare what weekend ridership has been there versus the rest of the system to just get a preliminary sense of whether or not these are affecting ridership at all?
So, yes, we have tried to understand the data for Saturday in particular. There's one very important wrinkle on the Saturday thing, which is, I mean, I figured this the first Saturday that I went over to try and park myself and see what it was like, which is, you have a choice between the kiss and ride lot and the park and ride lot. And when you know very intuitively and very quickly that the kiss and ride lot is free, you quickly divert and go and park for free. So the Saturday parking numbers were not controlled enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to solve for that so that we can get a better control and count. But generally speaking, so I think that the Saturday numbers are a little understated, mm-hmm. is what I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, it's and we're comparing the same 4-month block last year to this year's 4-month block. Just to try and keep consistency. And we know that during winter months, you know, things are a little bit slower anyway. We see a pretty correlated drop still between ridership and parking. So we didn't see a disproportionate or a much more aggravated drop in parking because of the $2. So I think what's going to be really important for Saturday is, one, exactly what you said, which is offering, you had mentioned around lower fees, but I think offering different scenarios for Saturday as well.
Sure.
Our hypothesis, frankly, is that a lot of, it's interesting, and we haven't come to a solution to this yet, which is there are a lot of people who are coming in from out of town and parking because they're visiting and using the metro system because that's part of the experience of visiting D.C., and they are not as price sensitive, frankly, be probably willing to pay the non-rider fee, but they're still metro riders. So right now we don't have a technology solution to differentiate between, unless it could be a registered smart trip card user. So there's lots of things to noodle on around Saturday. We are learning, but I think you're exactly right. We need to, any feedback that you have on what data we need to get and what you're interested in, I would love to know so that we can start putting that into place so that we have much more robust information the next time we come.
I'm really thrilled to hear that you're amenable to that, and we will take you up on that offer. And then the other one that I'll raise today is what are the limitations in extending the regular fee or the non-rider privileges to other modal transit users, so regional bus, metro bus? Why can't we do that?
We can, and we're going to.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was another thing we figured out pretty quickly. We're like, wait a minute.
Okay.
This should be an advantage. I think historically the predominant parkers are Metro Rail riders. But clearly we want to make sure that our Metro Bus customers who are also choosing to park get the benefit of being a rider.
Okay. That's all for now.
Okay, anything further? Okay, seeing none. Would like to move approval of Title 6 report for parking pilots and authorization for public hearing for parking programs. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
All right, Dave, thank you. The ayes have it. All right, the last item on the agenda is the board will be asked to grant the general manager authority to negotiate to purchase or lease new office space for Metro, as well as to sell the current Metro headquarters building subject to final board approval. So, Ms. Albert.
Great. So I just want to give a little bit of context for this presentation today. For many years, since 2002 or so, Metro has been evaluating what to do with this building. You know, it's an older building. It's needed investment into it. So everybody was very fixated on Jackson Graham Building. Clearly, it's in a, you know, really strong real estate market, so from a monetization perspective, there's a lot of logic. In 2016, before the general manager joined, the board and McKinsey developed a number of different, or McKinsey did a number of different recommendations for what Metro should do. And one of the things that they mentioned again was the Jackson Graham Building, and take a look at it again. As we discussed, where we have office employees, people who have administrative and office functions, yes, JGB is the largest office building that Metro owns. But in fact, we have double the number of staff across multiple locations. And when we started to look at what our total office footprint is, it was pretty significant, and it represented opportunities for cost savings across the board. And so we looked at 9 different facilities and locations, not just JGB. And so the subject of our presentation today and the solution set that we're going to talk about is not just for Jackson Graham Building, but it's for how Metro occupies a space and what our strategy is for that, and what the real estate solution is for that. And the purpose of that is really to reduce our overall footprint and save Metro some money. Also, improve the workplace conditions and fire and life safety, of course, always being an underpinning of everything we do. So that's the background. I'm going to share today with you what that strategy is, the results of which are primarily, or the goal of which, is to ensure employee safety, reduce what is currently, I mentioned 9 before, I'll come back to that, but it's in fact reducing 10 office space locations to 7, and our analysis was over a 20-year period from a financial evaluation perspective, and we believe that we would be saving Metro more than $130,000 as a result of implementing this strategy. Once I share the strategy with you, the authorization that we are seeking is subject to a final approval by the board, but that we can go out, start negotiating and executing purchase and sale agreements to acquire property. That more likely than not will be an acquisition of new property, but it may require negotiating some lease agreements in affiliation with this strategy. All of which are over are valued over $1 million. We would also like board authorization, again, subject to your final approval, to sell the Jackson Graham building. And then lastly, as part of these transactions, it is possible that some of the sellers of property or the landlords will require WMATA to indemnify them. This is not unusual. If we're going to be accessing a building to do due diligence on it, a landlord's going to want to know that we're going to take some financial responsibility if we do any damage. So that is just kind of a subset of what is needed to effectuate these transactions. So again, by background, we've been at this for 16 years. So it has been a long time. And that's just a little bit of the evaluation and analysis and board presentations that have been done to try and figure out what to do with Jackson Graham in particular. Next. So the question, I think, for everybody is, well, if you've been waiting around for 16 years, why don't you continue to do nothing? And we are at a critical point. This building has major building systems that are 45 years old and are at the ends of their useful lives. And once you start replacing building systems of a certain size and of a certain cost, there can be and will likely be ripples effects to bring the entire building up to code. So you can't go and surgically remove one building system and, you know, just manage costs that way. There will be a ripple effect because of the size of our building systems. Even though this building is to code because we're grandfathered, we are not to current standards for fire and life safety or accessibility. The easiest case in point is that there are no sprinkler systems in this building. But the list goes on about how we want to be the transit system that is safe for our employees, clearly, and is accessible to anybody who works or visits this building or any building. I mentioned the building systems being at the end of their useful life. If there were to be an emergency repair in JGB in particular, and it would require employees to vacate this building, we would be in reaction mode. And that has a 20% cost premium than if we were to do something proactively. So not only are there cost premiums that would be affiliated with a responsive approach, but of course, if you're scrambling because you know, plumbing isn't available in this building to go and find lease swing space, there is a, you know, loss of productivity, of course. And then, I'm not going to shy away from the fact that we are continuing to have to lease properties. We just leased 2 new office spaces just this past year because we don't, the configuration of the office spaces that we have right now are not efficient. And we can't keep adding people without doing dramatic renovation. So we are growing our operating costs even currently because the current offices that we own or occupy are not what they need to be. This is really just a sample. I want to give you a sense of, you know, this is not an air conditioning unit in the window. These are entire floors of air handlers and chillers and mechanical systems. The top right photo is an example of the 1970s way that, you know, the regulators and meters that show you what's going on. I mean, today's systems are completely regulated by digital automatic metered feedback. These are pictures of this building and the systems and the controls. And on the right is really the most important part, which is the age of many, many of our chilled water and air handlers, ranging on the low side. We have a couple that are 10 years old. The majority are 25 years and older, and then we've got a handful that are really in the 40-plus year range. So the nine buildings, when we started this about 8 months ago, we had nine facilities that we were looking at. They are dispersed through the region in Virginia, D.C., and in Maryland. And on the right-hand side, I've shared with you what the usable square feet are. This is office space, this particularly in the yards, Greenbelt, Alexandria, and Telegraph. It excludes any yard space. It's really just where the staff is, administrative types of staff. So usable square feet, and then the numbers of employees and contractors that are occupying those spaces. I've starred the four leased facilities. Again, this hits our operating expense budget, Bellcrest Road, L'Enfant Plaza, Professional Place, and 8th Street. And then since we've added two more leases to this list. So for a total of 661,000 usable square feet for a headcount of 3,100 employees total. Next. So we looked at a variety of different alternatives. The first one, of course, I've discussed a little bit, which is the do-nothing or the base case scenario. We evaluated renovating JGB as well as some of our other facilities, and this scenario also included collapsing the existing leases and bringing folks who are in lease space back into the fold. Scenario two would require, because we would need to replace leased office space with owned office space, does include the acquisition of an additional office building. But that's scenario two versus selling JGB, letting the leases run their course, and then acquiring new properties is what is scenario three. Scenario three is favorable across the board for a number of different reasons. All scenarios are about renovating facilities, so the ultimate goal is safer, healthier, more productive work environment. Both scenarios two and three accomplishes the reduction in number of office buildings. It also accomplishes the reduction of 100,000 usable square feet. That is very significant space saving for either of these scenarios. But scenario three is the one that saves Metro the most money, and that's in large part because the value of this building contributes to our overall effort. So we're now looking at implementation. And this year, calendar year, we would look to put the Jackson Graham building on the market. And that would be through a competitive bid process. We would be looking and inviting investors who are just, you know, pure financial offers, as well as developers. Sometimes they're one and the same. And then we would also this year seek to acquire a new headquarters building that would be located in D.C. We believe that building would be on the smaller size of an office building, but 100,000 to 250,000 square feet in the District of Columbia. And then once the D.C. location, particularly the building size, is known, then we would roll immediately into looking for an office acquisition, one in Virginia and one in Maryland. And we believe this permits us not only to operate as efficiently as possible from an operation perspective, but also to better serve the region and recruit staff from throughout the region because there's a convenient location. Again, I mentioned this indemnification. In order to actually effectuate some of these agreements, we need approval from the board to indemnify a third party. And then we would come back to the board after we've identified the building and the price to acquire, come back to the board for final approval. So the specific board approvals include authorizing staff to negotiate and execute purchase and sale agreements, as well as to negotiate lease agreements, also to put Jackson Graham Building on the market. And then lastly, for the board to authorize staff to indemnify third parties.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Albert. Questions, comments? Down this way. Michael, down this way.
Ian, let me call your attention to two of your slides, 8 and 9. I frankly find these two slides quite damning. inconsistent with the general thrust of your presentation. I say that because slide 8, at least as I read it, doesn't make the case for choosing to sell JDP as opposed to renovate. In fact, it shows that the operating cost savings, strange as it is to believe, of renovation are greater than the operating cost savings from moving. And the capital cost savings of less than $20 million over 20 years, roughly less than $1 million a year, is fairly, you know, peanuts in terms of WMATA's $1.8 billion annual operating budget. So while we're not approving today an actual sale proposal, I want to urge you, I want to just advise for you that you should come back. The proposal, if you're going to propose sale of KGB, that makes the economic case, because so far you haven't made, these slides don't make the economic case for a sale of KGB as opposed to a renovation. So we're voting on today to give you the authority to go out and lease services and lease sales. And you may have other factors in mind that would argue for sale of KGB as opposed to renovation, but you haven't presented them this presentation today and in these slides. So I just want to set up for you that concern that I have that if you come back, you want to make your case a damn good one if it's a case for sale.
Hey John, can you go to the other slide?
I just want to make two other points and then you can respond. Second of all, you make the statement somewhere that the headquarters should be located in D.C. Now, while this is inconsistent with the point I just made about renovating JGB, I think that from my point of view as a board member, you should be looking for the best deal for WMATA, whether that deal is in Roslyn or Crystal City or Friendship Heights in Maryland. That should be your objective and your goal, and you shouldn't at the onset be limiting your search for a headquarters site. You decide that a new headquarters is needed to D.C. As I read the resolution doesn't limit you searching for sites in the District of Columbia. And so I would urge general manager and staff to be looking for the best deal. This should be Amazon headquarters 2 for WMATA, not a preset decision that the site you decide to abandon and sell JGB to be the district. The third point I would just raise has to do with these third-party identifications. As you've discussed the identification, you've only discussed them in terms of a need for that in terms of the due diligence process. If that's what you're looking for, I could suggest an amendment that would limit the third-party identification authorization through the due diligence process. I'm not prepared to authorize a third-party identification for the sale and lease transactions that you may negotiate before you actually come back and present them without any sense of the scope of these identifications.
Sure.
And what's the potential financial impact for WMATA? So as it's presently structured, I couldn't support the kind of broad third-party identification authority you're looking for. Thank you.
Okay. Before answering, if I may, Mr. Chairman,
yeah,
just to clarify a few points, I think you can clarify some of the numbers. I think maybe we can do a better job of that, and I think it's there today. In terms of the location of the headquarters, the district isn't the issue. The issue is that we want a headquarters that is located near a primary transfer point within the system so that we can get to the most of the public as we hold meetings and things of that sort. That was the rationale of the location of the headquarters in the district. Again, it's really, and that wasn't expressed, but it's really, you know, like we have here at your ad gallery place where you have access to all the major lines very, very close to us. So that was part of the thinking there. And on the indemnification, that isn't on the sale of the issue. That is so that if we go in and look at the HVAC system, and we touch something, that's what that was trying to get to.
Right, the way it's been drafted is much broader than that. It's not limited to just the due diligence.
Okay, well, we can clarify that for sure.
Yes, we're starting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And if you could clarify in terms of the payback.
Yeah. So a couple different things. So these numbers, right, just as backup, we've looked at, and these numbers represent a nine-facility strategy that goes beyond JGB. But the most financially, you're right, in the big scheme of things, in big WMATA budget, it's not enormous savings. We still need to make a decision about this building. That doesn't change. Same thing for Telegraph Road. The conditions in Telegraph Road mandate an investment in that facility. So specifically, when you compare the choice to renovate versus sell, it is still financially favorable to sell. And these are guesstimates at those costs. This is the beginning, the spear of the process. We've tried to evaluate them. We will come back to the board with more financial information as specific property opportunities come online. This is what our very educated guest with Jones Lang LaSalle, doing this evaluation with us, as well as an architecture firm doing space programming, really trying to figure out how we shrink down responsibly our footprint and what savings we can achieve. That's what these results are. They're not firm numbers. Every property, we will be looking for the best deal that we can get, because we're hoping to bring these numbers down, bring the savings up. Yeah. So there's a lot more value engineering to be had.
Can you speak to the $20 million versus the $134 million that Mr. Goldman referenced, $20 million savings?
Sure. I believe, were you going across for capital cost savings, or were you adding?
No, I was just looking at the capital cost savings. $20 million.
Between $78 million and $95
million.
Right. It's still savings, and it's still, we have to make a choice between doing this. The other thing I'll just say, renovating JGB has that decision has other implications. One is, we would need to move out of this building, or we would need to do, two-floor by two-floor strategy. So in terms of an implementation process, is not the easiest, especially when we're trying to also address the needs of other facilities as well. The advantage of selling JGB, being able to hang on to it for a little period of time, is that the spear of this strategy includes, or the implementation is, allows a certain number of workers that are here today to go into the new DC building. And then JGB becomes some swing space as we need to renovate the rest of the buildings to achieve the greatest operational or the greatest space efficiencies in, for example, Alexandria Yard, the TSSM building, and some others. So if we renovate JGB, it introduces just more of an implementation challenge. And there are always delays associated with that. So there's two reasons. The third party identification, limitation to due diligence, no problem. I think that we can address that for you. Yeah.
Okay, Jim. All right. Hold on for a second. We'll try and get Mr. Horner back. David, are you there?
Yes, I'm back. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Jim.
Okay, David, welcome back. Nina, I want to say thank you. This is actually following the policy and procedures that the Capital and Strategic Planning Committee had brought to the board a couple months back, and that seems to be where we're going with this. And so this whole procedure is something that we did agree to, I believe. And so I just wanted to say thank you for following those procedures that we did agree to. And I was also, Mr. Goldman has left, but I wasn't understanding his question, really. Was he saying that you're saving less by going to the procedure of selling this building? Is that what he was saying?
No, I believe what he was saying was that the savings of scenario three were not material enough in his mind to move forward with a sale versus renovate.
Okay. And Paul,
so that the numbers are the savings are nominal between two and three, just by the numbers, you know, over a 20-year period. That's true. They're not dramatically different numbers there, but there's other strategic reasons as well as sort of implementation reasons.
Sure.
To sell JGB.
Because I was, Paul, does human capital strategy come into play here, where, you know, just attracting a workforce to a particular work location? I think you have to go much wider than the financial side here, too.
Correct.
And there's other things that need to be looked at as well. So.
No, I agree. I mean, it's one of the biggest issues. You know, we're trying to transform, you know, the workforce here. And part of that does require to be competitive at different levels. And part of that is where people work, and particularly people entering the workforce. They're expecting a certain type of work environment. And this facility does not reflect that at all. So it's very hard to recruit those types of people.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, anything further? Yes, Corbett?
Yeah, just a brief observation. It would be disastrous to try to renovate this building.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nonsensical any way you look at it. So I think we just should be mindful of this aspect of it.
Well, period. I'll correlate it to, you know, the shack in the nice neighborhood and a decision to renovate that. Within its existing footprint, as opposed to going and getting the space that you need and allowing that home to be, or that you know, the property that you did own to realize its full value.
And also the business interruption would be catastrophic.
I think it would be, honestly, from an implementation perspective, there's many advantages to number three. The other thing, too, is one of the other things that we want to acknowledge is that we are a regional system, and having regional presence of office, you know, in D.C., in Maryland, and in Virginia is a positive to us, both because we're closer to our customers across the region, as well as the ability to recruit people from across the region and not have their commute be the determining factor for not to join Metro.
Okay, thank you. Further, we've appeared to have lost several of our board members, sir. So, okay. All right. So we're going to move forward. Let them know we're moving forward. All right. The resolution that we're moving today is to move approval for the general manager to sell the Jackson Graham building, to negotiate the purchase and or lease of office space and related facilities where each property is valued over $1 million, to indemnify third parties if required to effectuate the office space acquisitions, all of that subject to final board approval. Actually, that's not right. It's the third one is not subject to final board approval. That goes into effect immediately. It's just the sale of the building and negotiating the purchase and or lease of office space related facilities where each property is valued at over $1 million, subject to board approval, and then finally to indemnify third parties if required to effectuate the office space acquisition. So I'd like to move this at this time. Is there a second?
Second.
So we've moved and seconded. Any discussion? Mr. Goldman. Sure.
Do we need to do that now?
Yeah, I don't think we need to do that now.
Can we, as far as putting the indemnification together, that can be done at a later time, can it? But
we strike the indemnification language entirely, yes. But that's the question, whether any indemnification is needed for the due diligence process.
I'm prepared to go forward with the language we have here, unless you want to make an amendment.
I would like to make an amendment, but I don't know what language of the amendment would work.
How does the rest of the board members feel? Or is everybody happy with this language, or somebody want to wait for an amendment? Because your amendment may not pass anyway.
I think we need to go forward.
Are you ready to go forward?
Yeah, I'm ready to go forward.
Well, we're not approving the language of the indemnification today. right? We're approving to provide an indemnification.
You're granting to the general manager a unrestricted authority to provide third-party indemnification.
Could we add, as it pertains to the due to, you know, or up until, subject to, you know, we're coming back to the board as soon as we, I don't know, just limited to the due diligence period?
I'm fine with that, yes. That, you're okay with that, but the council doesn't quite understand it. But if you're okay with limiting the indemnification to the due diligence process, I'm fine with that language. I would propound that language as the method to resolution.
Yes, our general counsel.
We have a general counsel.
Yeah, the only...
So the reading of the resolution is that the indemnification language is included in a PSA, which would otherwise have to come back to the board for final approval anyways. That's why I think there was some confusion as to indemnification for due diligence or some other purpose. So normally there would be an indemnification provision in the purchase and sale agreement, which would have to come back to the board for approval anyways.
Right.
Rita Fall, what do you think? Okay.
Yeah.
Everybody comfortable with that?
Yes.
All right.
The intent that it would otherwise, anyways. The PSA.
Could
as long as it's not going to significantly slow down the process, we're not going to meet again until September. We might have an offer that we're ready to go forward with between now and then.
And the other thing,
it still has to come to approval.
Well, hold on.
Well,
so I think there's an important.
Agreement will, but we're talking about the indemnification now.
Right.
So the purchase and sale agreement takes you from the period of time between today. Or whenever something's agreed to or negotiated. Okay, a building is identified. Everybody agrees that we want to enter into a purchase and sale agreement, a contract to purchase. It has an indemnification provision in it. That purchase and sale agreement expires when the building closes. So there is an automatic sunset on the indemnification. Period. We may be doing multiple of these because we may enter into a purchase and sale agreement and then due diligence. We are like, whoa, this is not what we expected. And we terminate that purchase and sale agreement. And then we move on to a new building. So I think, and every landlord may have a different requirement for indemnification. So the language isn't going to be a blanket, provision. I think it would be better to, I don't know. We need to think about, we're not going to be motivated to indemnify third parties willy-nilly. We're going to want to cap that exposure. I don't know how we write that in right now. But I think coming back to the board for every indemnification provision is going to be challenging because we are going to want to move quickly and we're going to want to move potentially on multiple buildings at once.
Right.
Board has final say on the agreement. I don't think we need final say on the indemnification.
Yeah, and the way you explained it makes it very difficult to do that.
Yeah.
So
the board has final say on closing and the terms. Yeah,
right.
That's right, on terms.
Yeah.
So the authorization is that we can negotiate and execute an agreement contingent on final board approval.
Correct.
Okay.
All right. Is there any further discussion then on this?
Just a question. Can you actually negotiate without having the indemnification? Is that part of the due diligence? Just help me understand that in the process.
It's possible. But by experience, when a landlord is allowing you access to their property for you to do due diligence, they will require indemnification. It's not necessary. Maybe a landlord would waive it, but we anticipate, particularly, just these are commercial properties, and the landlord has a responsibility probably not only to themselves but also their financial investors that they would require indemnification.
They're not going to waive it. They will not waive it.
No, I don't think so. I think more often than not we're going to be.
Yeah, to find yourself in that position.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Further? All right. So what's before us again, I'll read this again to make sure everybody understands. It's to seek board approval to sell the Jackson Graham building, negotiate the purchase and or lease of office space and related facilities where each property is valued over $1 million. Both of those are subject to board approval. And then thirdly, to indemnify third parties if required to effectuate the office space acquisitions. Is that correct? Is that what you're seeking, Ms. Albert? Yes. Okay, so I'd like to move.
Right. You already moved.
Moved in second, so it's already moved in second.
Yeah.
Okay, further discussion? Okay, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Opposed? Any opposition? Okay, the motion passes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to abstain.
Oh, abstentions. Okay. And Mr. Goldman will abstain. Okay, the motion passes. Okay, moving along. We have one final item of business on the agenda today, and that's to approve the consent item. This item will give the general manager the authority to negotiate and execute an agreement with Fairfax County to provide free Metro bus rides to students at J.E.B. Stewart Justice High School. Fairfax County will fully reimburse Metro for this program. So I'd like to move approval. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
The ayes have it. Okay. Now, last item on the agenda is reports by the different jurisdictions from the District of Columbia. I'm pleased to report that this week, earlier in the week, we cut the ribbon on the new soccer stadium, so we will have our first game in our new soccer stadium in the Buzzards Point area of Washington down by the baseball stadium on Saturday night. So welcome everybody to D.C. United's opening game at our new soccer stadium.
What metro stop do you recommend taking for that stadium, Jack?
What one would I say? The one at the baseball stadium, I guess. The closest one. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody have any ideas on that? What's the closest one for the Nash? For the, huh?
Yeah, stadium.
The stadium one, yeah, stadium one, yeah. That would be the closest one. It's a bit of a walk. But, yeah, that's the closest one. It is. So hopefully you all come out and support the soccer team. As was mentioned, Monday night is at Nats Park is the home run derby. And Tuesday night is the All-Star game. And Metro will be staying open late for both of those events. So, again, we welcome all of you to come to the All-Star game, the home run derby, and many of the other events that are taking place starting this weekend at Nats Park. And that's my report. So next, WSTC, Mr. Crawford.
We have nothing to report at this time.
Okay.
No report from
no report from Virginia. And the federal government.
No report.
No report. Okay. Lastly, in accordance with the bylaws, I, Jack Evans, request that the Board of Directors convene an executive session to discuss the following matters pursuant to Article 2, Paragraph 9, Subsection A, Budgetary Matters, B, Litigation, Investigations, and Other Legal Matters, C, Personnel and Labor Issues, F, Safety and Security Matters, and G, Real Estate Matters. So I'd like to move this at this time. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. Thank you very much, and we'll see everybody upstairs. The meeting's adjourned.